This is a trigger warning for this episode. There will be references to graphic colonial violence. Please be advised before listening. Hello and welcome to the podcast, A Very Brief Introduction to the British Empire. This is a podcast run by Uncomfortable Oxford, a social enterprise that runs walking tours in the city of Oxford.
We're very happy to be hosting on our podcast today Professor Gerry Kearns from Maynooth University in Ireland. Gerry Kearns works at the intersection of historical, political and medical themes in geography, and his books Geopolitics and Empire, The Legacy of Halford Mackinder, already engages very deeply with the legacies of the British Empire, and his current work is more specifically on the cultural politics of AIDS. Today, Gerry is going to talk to us about the story of Irish nationalist Roger Casement, who lived at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, and we will focus in particular on his career and how he built his thoughts around colonial resistance, first during his career in Africa and then later in Ireland.
Welcome, Gerry.
Yeah, we're really glad you returned for us. This lecture originally is based on a lecture you gave for us live on our Facebook live stream. But thanks for coming again to do the podcast.
You're welcome.
Yes, we're really happy to welcome you. And maybe you can just tell us a few words about Roger Casement for those who've never heard of him before.
Yeah, Roger Casement was born in Ireland 1864 to Protestant, born a Protestant in South Dublin. His father died when he was quite young, and he ended up being brought up for part of his childhood by relatives in Liverpool, from where he got jobs on boats going to Africa, rather low-level jobs, but he built up experience there. And out of that experience of trading in West Africa, he got a job with the British Foreign Office initially as a representative of the British in West Africa. And then eventually after that, he became a consul in West Africa, and then later on a consul in parts of Brazil and Peru. But through all of this, his interest in Irish nationalism grew, and he ended up as one of the leaders of the insurrection of 1916, the Irish Rebellion of 1916, for which he was a gun runner. And out of that episode, he was arrested and eventually executed by the British for treason. So that's the short, sharp introduction to Casement.
So Roger Casement began as an imperialist, or at least he joined in the civil service. So what were his beliefs at the beginning of his career?
I think we can see Roger Casement's beliefs early on from his reaction to the hut tax in Sierra Leone. It would be true to say that initially Roger Casement was in sympathy with the idea of British imperialism as a civilizing influence in Africa. And he was even willing to support this hut tax, which was a tax placed upon people in Sierra Leone that they had to pay in cash. And in order to get the cash, they had to work as wage laborers. It was a way of forcing subsistence farmers to become wage laborers. But Casement said of this hut tax that it was calculated to bring the native to a sense of individual responsibility. There we see the African savage being brought to individual participation in the public affairs of his country. And despite all the turmoil and uproar that has been made over the hut tax, I am sure, from my knowledge of Africa, that Colonel Cardew and Mr. Chamberlain are right. That's where he began. He began as a supporter of British imperialism as a civilizing force in Africa.
And so you're going to explain how that whole changed?
Yes, I'm going to suggest that there were six ways that Casement educated himself, or was educated, or learned a different perspective on British colonialism, to the extent that British colonialism became his principal enemy.
So Roger Casement had a career within the British administration in different African colonies. what was the event that started to kind of change his perception of the British Imperial Mission?
The event which first shocked him was the Boer War. He was sent to South Africa to investigate claims that Portugal was illegally, by British terms, illegally breaking a blockade that the British had placed on South Africa while the British tried to defeat the Boer uprising. And when he got there, he found that the British were resorting to a sort of scorched earth policy to starve the Boers of resources. They were destroying farms, and in the lecture I showed slides of the slaughtered sheep and the slaughtered cattle. And they collected up the farmers, the male farmers, their wives, their children, and put them in concentration camps so that they had a scorched earth policy and the Boers were unable to live off the land because there was nothing to live off. In these camps, perhaps a quarter of the people died and it became a national scandal. And Casement saw this. But Casement also saw the treatment of Chinese labour brought into South Africa at the end of the war to rebuild the economy, to pay back the cost of the war from the mining of gold. And he found the violence with which the Chinese labour was disciplined quite shocking. So in these two ways, he had an education in the violence that's at the heart of imperialism.
Casement is really famous, I think, for writing a number of reports. Did he write anything about what he saw at the Boer War?
Not very much in official capacity. He had a specifically narrow task about monitoring Portuguese trade, and he reported on that. But in his letters to acquaintances, and later on, even in his testimony or his interrogation after he was arrested for treason, he referred to the Boer War as a thing which started him to reflect negatively upon British imperialism in Africa as a civilizing mission. He said to his interrogator in April 1916 that he began to feel shame at what he was doing in South Africa, what the British mission in South Africa was.
So then where did he go after he left South Africa?
The next most important episode was his time as British consul at Boma, in the Congo, the Belgian Congo. The Belgian Congo was a concession to Belgium that arose out of the 1885 Berlin Congress that carved up Africa among the European colonial powers. Belgium was given control of the Congo, not because it was a powerful European power, but because it wasn't. And instead of having the Europeans fighting over this incredibly wealthy part of Africa, they decided to let Belgium manage it on behalf of them all. And therefore, Belgium was to establish the basis for a civilized use of the Congo by all of the European companies that got concessions to get rubber. And it could raise money locally to pay for its administration. But Casement heard stories about the gross mistreatment of people who were charged with collecting the rubber. The Belgians were effectively using this tax as a way of extorting rubber out of the Congo. So they levied a tax which they collected in rubber. They set the tax at what they thought a village could possibly bring in if working full out. And then they sent in troops to enforce the collection of the tax. And this enforcing of the collection of the tax gave rise to a number of acts of violence against villages. Villages were burned down, individual villagers were beaten, some of them were mutilated. And stories like this had been coming out from the Congo. But Casement collected testimony, and in one case, he had someone who had a young man who had been mutilated confront the specific soldier who had cut his hand off. And Casement then took down the testimony, witnessed it, and sent it back to London. It was therefore impossible for the British government to ignore the abuses of the indigenous people of the Congo. under the auspices of this supposedly civilizing Belgian society.
What was Pisan's mindset when he was collecting those testimonies? Was he already making connections with resistance to British rule in Ireland, was it for him still very detached from what he had experienced at home?
I think it was somewhat detached at this point. This is 1903, 1904. When he comes back to Britain, physically he's exhausted. He's been out in parts where it was rather unhealthy for him. And he has to write up his report. He has his diaries. He has his notes. He's writing up his reports. And he's trying to get them past the Foreign Office. He's trying to get them into the official record. He's trying to be able to say the things he wants to say for the official record. And he's facing opposition from the Belgian political representatives in Britain, from representatives of the rubber companies, from some of the traders in the area. So it's quite a struggle to get this report approved and published. And he decides to go to Ireland to recuperate, to recharge his batteries, to recover from these efforts. And this is 1904, 1905. And in this period, he begins to engage more directly with cultural nationalism. He engages with the Irish language movement. He goes to classes to learn Irish. He engages with movements to celebrate Irish history, Irish culture, Irish music, Irish dress. And in this time, he reconnects with an Ireland that he left behind as a child. But he reconnects with it historically in the company of people who were exploring the extent to which this civilized Ireland had been destroyed by colonial Britain. And it's after this that he puts together in his mind what he is learning about Ireland with what he saw in the Congo, that colonialism does the same sorts of things in all places. In all places, it's based on extortion. In all places, it's based on violence. In all places, it's based on taking from the indigenous people control over the resources among which they lived. And that, I think, is where the connection of Ireland into this broader critique of colonialism begins to take root. It's after he comes back from the Congo, I think, that this intensifies.
So if we were to summarize, this is someone who goes to South Africa, witnesses the horrors and the atrocities of war, reports on Congo, and then comes back and tries to contribute to a form of change, connecting it to his own history or his own ancestry and his own cultural world. And I'm actually quite interested as well in what you mentioned about the collecting of testimonies. I'm guessing that requires a great deal of empathy. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about that process?
One of the things that Caseman has from the very beginning is something of a distance from the worst forms of racial chauvinism. I won't put it much stronger than that. But there's a sense that in even in these early letters, you know, he's willing to travel in railway carriages with people of color. He makes an effort to learn local languages, or at least enough to communicate to some degree. He is known for going into the interior without much of an armed guard. He's not moving through these territories protected by force of arms. And that is one side of it, this lack of racial chauvinism, this belief in listening. Another side of it is, I think, his sexuality. I think cruising as a form of as a form of sex life is really important to Casement. I'm describing Casement's sex life as having a large element of cruising. In fact, I think this is a majority, even perhaps, of his sex life. Cruising is going out, wandering around, looking for sex. It's based on adventitious encounters, contingent meetings. Often there are particular places in the city where people who wish to meet each other for somewhat anonymous sex go. They hang out, they bump into each other, they exchange glances or other sorts of signals and decide whether or not they wish to have sex. And this pattern is prominent in Casement's life. Some places offer him more opportunities than others, and that's also evident. And he looks back longingly sometimes when he's on his own to those places where the cruising was especially good. He mentions the Colosseum at Rome as being a particularly good place to go cruising. That's what cruising means. I don't think that the term was used in this way in the 19th century, so it's somewhat anachronistic for me to use it, but I think it does describe the sex life that I'm talking about. And as with Oscar Wilde, there's often a crossing of class boundaries or boundaries of various kinds that may be part of the erotic charge of the cruising, or it may be that this is an environment in which he has the money make people more interested in him. But sexual cruising and approaching people and offering them money for sex or asking if they're interested in sex is an extremely important part of Casement's life, both in Britain. He talks about where he hangs out in London, but almost anywhere he goes, he tries to find places where he can go cruising. There's a very interesting one from quite late in his life when he's in the United States, and he goes out on Broadway and finds there a Norwegian sailor that he'd met many years before who was also out cruising, and they get together. So cruising meant that he moved in a milieu and learned and learned the argot of that milieu. I mean, his diaries have African words, local African words for sexual acts and so on. But I think that there's also something there about a kind of empathy that's part of cruising. It's certainly, if you're sharing your sex life with people, then you're quite intimate with them, and you are in some ways acknowledging their humanity. And it's quite clear from the diaries, and I think if you look at the way he talks about his interactions, these are consensual interactions. They may involve exchanges of gifts or cash, but they are consensual. They're not based on prevailing by force in any way. So what we have here are non-abusive, consensual interactions with people of different classes, people of different races, both as an active and a passive partner sexually. And I think that is part of this lack of racial chauvinism, which I think leads on to a certain sort of empathy. So I think that he had less difficulty than some white people of the time had in seeing the humanity of the black person.
I'm just going to challenge you on that, Jerry, because can this relationship really be consensual in that there's these very strong power dynamics between, you know, a colonial official of some sort or an individual coming from a European country, you know, and engaging in sexual acts with an individual who's in the oppressed indigenous cultures?
I want to suggest that these relationships were consensual. He was willing to take no for an answer and often did. And I think that's part of the dynamic of cruising. You ask lots of people and some say yes. And there may be gifts exchanged. But there's a difference between something being consensual and having an inequality in it and it being abusive. In fact, I think difference is often integral to erotic charge. I also think that inequalities are part of many sexual relationships. And if sex was only to take place between people who are absolute equals, there'd be very little sex. So we do often enter into relationships with people where there are inequalities, but we try to base those relationships on respect for the other, lack of abuse, and consent. Of course, in most patriarchal societies, or all patriarchal societies, sexual relations between all men and all women involve not only a difference, but a fundamental inequality. And yet we find ways to negotiate that, or many of us find ways to negotiate that. so that we can have relationships which are mutually satisfying, even though they're based on inequality. It's not an unusual thing in a sexual relationship for there to be inequality.
You have Roger Casement's testimonies that he collected while he was working in Southern Africa, in the Congo, and you also have his diaries, which are other kind of perspectives on the people he has met throughout his career. How does it inform his later professional career within the British Empire and later his involvement with the Irish nationalist cause?
I think that when he goes to South America and he goes into the rubber tapping region between Peru, Colombia, Brazil, the region of the Putumayo, when he goes into that area, his understanding of colonialism is not only that it is a system of expropriation, but that it's a system of expropriation that had been done to the Irish too. And he's, by this stage, he has connected the Irish question to the broader question of colonialism in Africa and South America. And his letters back from Putumayo, his letters back from South America in period 1910 to 1913, have many, many reflections upon Ireland, have many, many reflections upon the continuity in his mind between British colonialism in Ireland and European colonialism in South America. And you see him say, for example, that he finds it difficult to get this message about the fundamental evils of colonialism across to the people in the Foreign Office. And he realizes that the difference is that he is looking at the situation, he says, through the eyes of another race. A race that has already been hounded, a race that has already been oppressed. And he's speaking here of the Irish as a race. People often talked about nationalities as races in this time. And he's saying that effectively, I could see the evils of colonialism as a system at this stage because I understood myself to be Irish, because I understood how this was just playing out yet again what had been done in Ireland. And it gives him a much richer theory of colonialism rather than the focus on individual abuses that the British press was half willing to listen to. It was much harder to get them to see colonialism as an abusive system rather than colonialism as an essentially civilizing system which might have one or two bad apples, one or two abusive administrators. Casement said no, even if the system was run by saints and angels, it would still be abusive. And that's what comes, I think, from the Irish context.
Again, it seems this key idea of empathy that you're highlighting really in his process, in his perspective on issues and on matters relating to this. I'm wondering, were there specific things that happened in Putumayo that you would like to tell us about?
I think that Casement was able to put himself in the position of the people who were being colonized because he identified with the Irish people as having been colonized. So there was a connection there that reinforced the empathy that I say he had already developed out of his lack of racial chauvinism and also out of his cruising. And in South America, among the things that he saw was the joyful society that the native people otherwise shared. He saw them dancing, went swimming with them. He had this sense of them as, in a sense, proto-socialists, that they were, in a sense, egalitarian. They treated each other well. And again, he saw between that kind of joyful civilization, that love of fun, that love of sensuality, that love of having a good time, that love of music, that love of dance, that love of bodily expression. He saw that as, in a sense, pre-modern Ireland, before the bourgeois calculus of utilitarian profitability was imposed through colonialism. And he saw another connection, therefore, with the Irish. The Irish, to him, were egalitarian, cheerful, joyful. They saw life as resting on more than just making money. But it was the British with their capitalist modernity who reduced life to the bottom dollar, who reduced life to profit and loss, who reduced life simply down to the calculus of what could feed shareholders' profits. And I think it was the joy that Casement saw among Indigenous people in South America that comes through to me most strikingly in the way he wrote about them.
So just to summarize then, we started off with the imperial beliefs that he held, which were very much in keeping with, you know, the imperial mission of the British. But then he went through these six lessons that you've said. So first, the experiences in the Boer War and seeing concentration camps and the scorched earth policies of the British. Then seeing the horrific atrocities in the Congo of mutilation and oppression. Then a connection with his Irish nationalism back at home in his rest period. And seeing the ways in which the society had changed since British oppression had taken over, followed by his sexuality and the empathy he developed for individuals worldwide as he experienced more sexual encounters and cruising. And lastly, here is the fifth one you said, which is his experience in Putumayo, that joy he sees in the Indigenous expression of culture, and assumably some of the horrors of rubber extraction itself as well. So what's the sixth lesson then, the final lesson that really changes his perspective and brings him to his ultimate execution?
Yes, finally, Casement becomes fixated not on colonialism as such, but on British colonialism. In a sense, the force of his Irish attachment somewhat narrows his critique of colonialism, and he becomes almost monomaniacally obsessed with the British as the fundamental global colonial power. He's sort of willing almost to forgive some of these other colonial atrocities because the British are just systematically so much worse and so much more hypocritical, and they are the ones who've done it to Ireland. And so what happens after about 1912, from there on, he is just fixated on British colonialism, bringing down British colonialism in Ireland. And he not only joins a number of cultural nationalist movements in Ireland and is involved in setting some of them up, such as the Gaelic Athletics Association and so on, but he becomes involved with an insurrectionary side of Irish nationalism, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which has affiliates in Britain, in Ireland, but also very importantly in North America. It's a diasporic nationalist movement that has as its goal the overthrow by physical force of British rule in Ireland. And Casement gets involved in this. He goes to the United States to raise money for arming an Irish rebellion. He gives speeches in New York, in Boston. And while he's in the United States, a gun-running escapade that he had a hand in organizing lands some guns at Hoth in July 1914. And Casement is also precipitated into this gun-running and this emphasis on force of arms because of the failure, in his eyes, of a certain sort of cultural nationalist appeal. Casement thought that he could persuade Unionists in the north of Ireland that they were fundamentally Irish and they should throw in their lot with their Catholic neighbours and have an Ireland for the Irish, which would include Protestants and Catholics, would include people who had descended from the so-called planter class, as well as the indigenous people from whom that planter class had taken the land. But by 1913, he observes that the Unionists are willing to use force of arms to resist Ireland getting independence. And he's present at a speech that Edward Carson gives, and where Carson says, the only basis of law is force. And the only basis of law in Ireland will be British force. And if British force abandons us, it'll be our force. And the Union, the Ulster Volunteers are able to land thousands of guns unmolested into Northern Ireland. And it's in response to that that Casement says the Irish nationalists in the south have to have a similar weapons base in order to prevail. And it's on that basis that he goes to North America, raises money for gun running, and then after the news of the successful landing of, I don't know how many it was, I don't even think it was 100, but several dozen sets of guns in Howth, the Irish in America open up their pockets and start giving lots of money to the nationalist cause. So now Casement has got money, but he's in the United States. The war starts, and he has to decide what to do. And his fixation with British colonialism means that he is willing to support Germany in allowing Germany to get more colonies at the expense of Britain. So, while Casement's in the United States raising money for guns, the First World War starts, 1914. And this is effectively a war between early and late industrialisers over access to colonies. So the late industrialisers, Germany, Central European powers, are fighting the early industrialisers, France and Britain, to get a larger share of the colonies that France and Britain have already taken control of. And this is necessary because industrialization relies upon foreign markets. It also relies upon sources of raw materials from abroad. And the British and the French have carved up a lot of the potential colonies between themselves. Therefore, Germany wants to displace Britain's hegemony so that a new global colonial order can be produced in which Germany has a larger slice of the pie. This is the essence of the First World War, but not for Casement. For Casement, the essence of the First World War was Britain wanted to dominate the world. It could do so because it controlled the seas. In being able to dominate the world, the British had been able to impose their colonial rule all over the place, beginning in Ireland, but then the Caribbean, India, Africa, Australasia, and so on. So for Casement, there was he thought there might be a way to show the Germans that to break the British control of the seas, they had to detach Ireland from Britain. That if Ireland was detached from Britain, Britain would no longer have control of the Atlantic, because there would be this island out there which was guarding the seaways into Europe from North America. And that island would be independent. It wouldn't be a British fortress. The Germans could then be given a way to understand that their war aims should include the liberation of Ireland from British colonial rule. And so Casement then thinks that he can go to Germany with the money that he's raised in the United States, buy guns in Germany, bring them to Ireland, spend time in Germany more or less almost as a foreign a diplomat for independent Ireland, and persuade the Germans that their war aim should include the liberation of Ireland.
So this is probably one of the limits of Roger Casement's kind of understanding of colonialism as a system, because he, as you mentioned, he becomes so focused on the British Empire that he seems to not necessarily want the end of colonialism, provided that Ireland becomes independent. So he's not really opposing a possible German Empire in different parts of the world should Germany win the First World War. Is that right?
So I think so. I think there's a sense in which it's let's deal with Ireland first, and I will magnanimously put up with German colonialism in other parts of the world so that I can end British colonialism in Ireland. It's a calculation. Yes, that is a real limitation. As I say, I think that after 1912, the focus of his critique of colonialism becomes so fixated on Britain that it loses some elements of that broad critique that I think he had between, say, 1910 and 1912.
How does this part of his life develop? What happens from here on?
So, from 1911, 1912, up to 1914, Casement is writing a series of journalistic articles warning about the coming war. He's saying there is going to be a war. There's going to be a war because the competition between Britain and Germany is inevitable. And he tries to position Ireland in that war. He tries to show that British colonial rule in Ireland is essential to British colonial rule more broadly. And therefore, if your war aim is to end British colonial domination, you've got to end it in Ireland first. And that, so that's his message to the world. He would like to persuade the United States not to align with Britain. We'd like to persuade the United States that it too has an interest in British colonial hegemony, global colonial hegemony being broken. But when the war starts and it's Germany against Britain, remember the United States doesn't join till later on, he is trying to lobby Germany to have the liberation of Ireland as part of its war aims. He goes to Germany. He has this cash. He tries to buy weapons from a country that's at war and therefore wants a lot of its weapons for itself. But he does get some weapons. He goes to prisoner of war camps in Germany and tries to recruit Irish-born soldiers who are in the British Army and have been captured by the Germans. He tries to recruit them to an Irish brigade that he thinks he can take with him back to Ireland to join the insurrection, the rising that he knows is being prepared for. And the rising was being prepared by the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and also somewhat independently by the socialist, the trade union movement around the Irish Citizens Army. But a date was set, Easter weekend, 1916. And so with that goal in mind, Casement really intensifies his efforts to get guns sent into Ireland. And a boat is commissioned to carry some really old guns, I think from the 1870s, into Ireland, to land them in Ireland. And Casement goes along in the submarine that is tracking the boat, protecting the boat from potential British aggression. And they get to the west coast of Ireland near Tralee, and the attempt is made to bring the boat in. For various reasons, the attempt is unsuccessful. The people who are supposed to meet the boat aren't at the right place at the right time, and so on and so on and so on. And the German officers decide to scuttle the boat to send the guns to the bottom of the ocean rather than have them taken by the British. And that's where they are now. Casement is landed from the U-boat. He goes ashore, and shortly after arriving on Banner Strand in the west of Ireland, he is picked up by the local police. As soon as they realise who they have, he'd already been betrayed. The British knew he was coming, in a sense. He is sent to London. And it's in London that he's then interrogated in the Tower of London and then brought to trial for treason.
I guess one of the most controversial discussions running the trials of Roger Casement is how his diaries were used against him to some extent, but also how it kind of deflated the solidarity or the support he could have received from the Irish nationalist cause. Could you tell us a bit more about this?
Yes, the British went to great lengths to investigate elements of Casement's sex life, chasing up names that were mentioned in his letters, in his diaries, interviewing people. They had the testimony of this Norwegian sailor I told you about that he bumped into once again on the Broadway in New York and that he hooked up with. And this guy, Christensen, basically sold his story of Casement to the British. And so the British knew that Christensen was Casement's lover. They knew, Casement says that the people in the Foreign Office knew about his sex life and continued to employ him as a consul. Despite this, but this sex life was a way of driving a wedge between Casement and the likely public campaign that might have happened to prevent his execution. And the British took photographs of pages from the diary and sent them to prominent figures, particularly in the United States, to leading nationalists, nationalist journalists, and so on, and also to other journalists, both in Britain and in the United States. So the story started to appear, hinting at Casement's perversity. The extracts from the diary that were photographed were also shown to Catholic bishops in London and sent to Dublin. The Catholic Church was not willing to defend a Protestant nationalist who also had these, to their mind, moral failings. They'd done the same thing earlier with Charles Stuart Parnell, another prominent Protestant nationalist that the Catholic Church undermined on the basis of his morality. In the case of Parnell, his adulterous affair with a woman. The Irish nationalists were also conservative morally, and they were, many of them were Catholics. They didn't find Casement's sexuality something that they were comfortable with. And Casement was told that were he to speak in his defence at his trial, the British could bring up anything they wished to counter him, and that they could therefore make public reference to his sexuality and so on. And Casement was told, if this becomes more public, if your sexuality becomes a scandal, it will actually undermine the cause of Irish nationalism. We'll find it harder to get support for an Irish insurrection if Irish people think it's being led by somebody who they see as a moral reprobate. And for these reasons, Casement did not speak at his own trial. He offered no defence himself. He did not take the stand. His trial was conducted on the basis of a certain technicality. His defence was that a certain way of reading treason didn't apply to his case. And I think it's quite clear that Casement's sexuality was an effective secret weapon of the British, semi-secret, because it was hinted at in the press. But it made it very difficult for many Irish nationalists to publicly support him.
So it seems as though he was effectively silenced during the trial. Was he given an opportunity to speak at any other time?
Yes. In a trial where somebody is condemned, they have a chance to speak from the dock after sentence, and the other side can't reply. So Casement had this one opportunity to speak without the possibility of a British reply. And he took it. He wrote a speech about colonialism, about force, and about loyalty. He was being charged with treason, which is the crime of not being loyal to a legitimate state authority, in this case in time of war. But loyalty, he said, is a sentiment, not a law. In other words, it's a feeling. Loyalty is not something that can be demanded through law. He said, and this is, I think, really striking from someone who's standing there about to be led away to be hanged. It rests on love, not on restraint. The government of Ireland by England rests on restraint and not on law. And because it demands no love, it can evoke no loyalty. So he's saying that British rule is illegitimate because Britain can't rule through consent in Ireland. And if Britain can't rule through consent in Ireland, how can it say it demands the loyalty of people? He goes on, this is the condemnation of English rule, of English-made law, of English government in Ireland, that it dare not rest on the will of the Irish people, but exists in defiance of their will, that it is a rule derived not from right, but from conquest. And he's right. I mean, in so many ways, British rule in Ireland did not rest upon consent. Jury trial was suspended for much of the 19th and early 20th century. A whole series of civil liberties which were allowed in Britain were not allowed in Ireland. The right to bear arms, for example. In a whole series of ways, Ireland was governed in a way that's similar to Giorgio Agamben's idea of the exception. That civil liberties were declared for Ireland, but then they were immediately suspended because there was no way of controlling the Irish colony without suspending those freedoms. Casement goes on, "Conquest, my lord, gives no title, and if it exists over the body, it fails over the mind. It can exert no empire over men's reason and judgment and affections. And it is from this law of conquest without title to the reason, judgment, and affection of my countrymen that I appeal." So he's appealing against the idea that conquest gives the British a right to charge him with treason. And he goes on to talk about empire in the context of this force. And you can see all the things he learned from the Boer War, all the things he learned from his time in the Congo, all the things he learned from Putumayo, and all the things he learned from cultural nationalism and his study of the history of British colonialism in Ireland. You can see them all coming together in this. "That blessed word empire that bears so paradoxical resemblance to charity. For if charity begins at home, empire begins in other men's homes, and both may cover a multitude of sins. I, for one, was determined that Ireland was much more to me than empire. And if charity begins at home, so must loyalty. Since arms were so necessary to make our organisation a reality and to give to the minds of Irishmen menaced with the most outrageous threats a sense of security, it was our bounden duty to get arms before all else." And here's how he concluded before he was taken away. "Where all your rights have become only an accumulated wrong, where men must beg with bated breath for leave to subsist in their own land, to think their own thoughts, to sing their own songs, to garner the fruits of their own labours, and, even while they beg, to these things inexorably withdrawn from them, then, surely, it is a braver, a saner, and a truer thing to be a rebel in act and deed against such circumstances as these, than tamely to accept it as the natural lot of men." That's the end from the doc. A very powerful statement of the relationship between force and empire and between love and loyalty, and his case for his Irish identification as trumping the British claim upon his loyalty.
Well, that was a really shocking, you know, good way to finish with those words. Before we wrap up this lecture on Casement, I wondered if you could just speak a little bit about his continued legacy today and how he's viewed, you know, a century later after all these events have happened and, you know, a lot more has happened in the last century.
Casement has always been a bit of a difficult figure for Irish politicians and Irish culture because of his sexuality. But there are a number of ways that Ireland has embraced him. Firstly, he was extremely important to James Joyce. James Joyce's the figure that James Joyce created that, in a sense, carries Joyce's gospel is Bloom in Ulysses. And in the middle of Ulysses, Leopold Bloom is in a pub arguing with an Irish nationalist who is attacking him as Jewish and therefore not properly Irish, and is saying that Bloom doesn't really belong anywhere. And Bloom says he's Irish. I'm born in Ireland. And they say, Jewish people can't have a nationality because they're not willing to fight for it and so on. And Bloom comes to this rebuttal of the argument about force and nationalism and identity, and his rebuttal has clear echoes of Casement in it. "I'm talking about injustice," says Bloom. "Right," says John Wyse. "Stand up to it then with force, like men. That's an almanac picture for you. Mark for a soft-nosed bullet, old lardy face standing up to the business end of a gun. Gob, he'd adorn a sweeping brush, so he would, if he only had a nurse's apron on him. And then he collapses all of a sudden, twisting around all the opposite as limp as a wet rag. And this is Bloom. "But it's no use," says he. "Force, hatred, history and all that. That's not life for men and women. Insult and hatred. And everybody knows that it's the very opposite of that that is really life." "What?" says Alf. "Love," says Bloom. "I mean the opposite of hatred." And we know Joyce was reading Casement. He, in his journalism, he discusses, he mentions Casement's speech from the dock. And let me just finish with a final legacy. When Ireland celebrated the centenary of the Rising of 1916 in 2016, a number of artistic projects were commissioned to commemorate the centenary. And one of the most powerful and effective was called the Casement Project. And it was a series of dance workshops, conferences, and theatre events around the legacy of Roger Casement. And in a sense, its highlight was a gathering on Banner Strand, where Casement had landed, and an attempt to give Casement a welcome into a new island, an island that was more multicultural, an island that was more accepting of sexual difference, an island that would shortly afterwards pass marriage equality by consent of the people. Gay marriage legally allowed in Ireland. There is still work to be done, but this is a more welcoming island for the legacy of Roger Casement than the one that he was taken out of.
That's a perfect way to finish this lecture. So thank you very much, Jerry, for joining us and for recording this podcast with us. The lecture was already very powerful and we had lots of a very engaged audience, and I'm very happy that we'll be also able to release it as a podcast.
Thank you, Jerry, for a great podcast today. We really enjoyed having you.
Yep, thank you very much for the invitation, and have fun with all your projects. They're all very exciting.
If you're interested in hearing the longer version of this lecture, which Jerry gave for Uncomfortable Oxford, it's available on our website, www.uncomfortableoxford.com. Under lectures, you can see that live, so you can see his slides and images that he's referring to, and a lot more detailed information, as the lecture went on a little bit longer than this podcast did.
And on this website, you'll also find many other educational resources, such as blog posts and reading lists, as well as course structures for stories and translation sessions.